Patrick Luther is the very model of a fast starter. He got interested in the business while he was still in high school, and by the time he was 19, he'd already earned his residential sales license. When he was studying finance at Arizona State, he found time to work as an analyst. So it doesn't come as a surprise that Patrick has been on our radar for the better part of a decade. Back in 2015, he was named a CPE Star to Watch as one of the young professionals who represent the rising generation of industry leaders. In 2016, he joined SRS, where he and his longtime business partner, Matthew Musabi, co-founded the firm's NetLease Retail Advisory Group. Since then, Patrick has gone on to gain recognition as one of the nation's leading NetLease investment advisors. Hello, and welcome back to Investment Matters. I'm Paul Rosta, executive editor at CPE. Recently, we caught up with Patrick Luther for the first time in a few years. He told us why starting his career as a leasing broker was so valuable for his long, successful run as an investment advisor. Fast forwarding to today, he gave us his frank perspective on this tough investment and finance market. As he puts it, we're doing more problem solving for owners than making them happy. Also in this episode, he makes the case for staying focused on old school business practices, which he believes are all the more important in the new digital age. It's a compelling observation for professionals at any stage of their careers. Take a listen. Patrick Luther, welcome to Investment Matters. Really nice to be with you today.
Good morning. I'm excited. Thank you.
Well, speaking of the morning, I just want to let our audience know that as we are recording this episode, it is only a little after 7 a.m. in Orange County, California, which is where my guest is based. So, Patrick, you are getting extra credit today, not only for finding time for this interview, but finding it even before the start of what's going to be a really long workday for you. So I really appreciate you being such a good sport.
You bet. You know, we start on East Coast time. It seems like the world operates around New York City. So I start getting called at 5 a.m. typically.
So this hour is no stranger to you then?
It's manageable. A couple cups of coffee.
That always helps. Now, speaking of getting an early start, that is an appropriate way to begin our conversation. Could you tell us about your early years in the business? Because as I understand it, you really started out when you were a teenager. So when did you get your foot in the door? How did you get interested? Did anyone encourage you at the outset to explore this business?
Yes, actually. It's all my mom's fault. I went to a Catholic high school in Phoenix, and there was always a fountain or an arch or a new athletic facility that bore the name of whatever donor had financed it. And I did some Googling and pointed to real estate, and real estate being sort of the source of funds or the background by which these families had the wherewithal to donate these structures. So, I would go home at night and, mom would say, oh yeah, that's the such and such family that put that up. They develop shopping centers, they develop industrial buildings, et cetera.
And you went on to earn your degree in finance from Arizona State. But the timing was interesting because it was just in time for the great financial crisis. And needless to say, that wasn't a real great time for anybody looking for a job in the industry, let alone a new college grad. So you got yourself a stack of resumes and took a rather consequential trip to Las Vegas. How did all of that wind up playing out? And what exactly happened?
It didn't. Well, obviously, I'm still here, so everything was fine. But, I was not overly successful with my first ICSC. I think I was 21 years old. It was right May of 08, I want to say. And, the economy was in shambles. Bear had just collapsed. Lehman was about to collapse. And I essentially went up to every major brokerage house and passed out these resumes. I got one call back. And that's the job I ended up taking in August of 2008 then. And it was with Grubb and Ellis in Las Vegas, Nevada. So I ended up back in Las Vegas 3 months after ICSC concluded, sitting in the Grub office.
Well, in the years since, you have made a name for yourself in retail investment, obviously, but you did initially spend a couple of years in another area learning the leasing side of the business. So what has been the value of that experience for your career in investment?
It's leasing, and the understanding of leasing is critical even now. At SRS, first and foremost, it is a tenant representation and leasing company. So the investment sales practice that I run was, until we ended up growing that business, was sort of an ancillary service to owners if they wanted to sell. But the real focus was, we're buying a piece of land or we're buying existing space, a retail center, and we need to fill vacancy. We need to grow NOI. So understanding not only, how leasing assumptions work and play into the investment discussion, but then understanding where the occupant is going, where the retailer is going, and what retailers, frankly, are expanding. That list of who's doing what, from an occupier and tenant standpoint, it changes every 6 months. Tenants come and go. They go bankrupt. They get new partners, and they set off on a rapid growth trajectory. Leasing, in my opinion, is sort of the crux of, it's where the rubber meets the road. I can't sell something if it's not stabilized from a leasing standpoint.
Well, let's fast forward then to the current investment picture. What are the main trends that you're tracking at SRS right now in retail, and particularly retail net lease, if you would like to focus on that? For example, which retail net lease categories do you expect will have particularly strong potential for the next, say, 3 to 5 years? Are there any categories in which you expect net lease retailers to grow their footprint significantly?
Sure. So you'll continue to see the growth within the dollar store segment. You have a consumer in the U.S., particularly in a recession, right, that is going to trade down. So, this economy seems to be very much a function of or a case of haves and have-nots. There's a very high-end customer, and then there's a customer that's living paycheck to paycheck. The dollar stores have really helped that customer out by giving them product at an affordable price. Additionally, you have the automotive retailers like O'Reilly Automotive being one. In a recession, customers fix their vehicles rather than buy new vehicles. So the auto parts guys tend to do very well. The traditional grocers remain very active in all shapes and sizes. You have the full service grocery stores, and then you have the groups like Aldi, ALDI, that operate out of an 18 to 20,000 square foot store. Retail as a whole, if this recession has an impact on real estate in general as an asset class, I don't see retail as being dramatically affected, versus something like office. I think that I see much more pressure in the office space than I do in retail. So this whole retail apocalypse, which was sort of one of the buzzwords in the last Great Recession, I don't think you're going to start to see as much failures within the retail product type.
Well, what does the investment picture look like to you so far this year? And how do you expect volume to compare to the past couple of years, again, in the net lease sector? For example, to what extent are you seeing that bid-ask gap that we've heard so much about generally in the commercial real estate industry across sectors?
So market volume in 2023, we just finished quarter one at the time of this interview. We compared that to Q1 of 2022. So we looked at this time this year versus this time last year. And we were fortunate. Our shop was down about 38% in terms of transaction volume, dollar volume of what we sold. You examine the market as a whole, net lease retail. In quarter one, there were in 2023, there were about 700 transactions, 750 plus or minus. Last year in 2022, there were over 1,500 transactions. So we're seeing volume at right currently, we're seeing the Q1 volume come in at about 40 to 50% of what it was last year. Again, we're doing SRS is doing a little bit better than the national average. We're beating that and kind of holding transactions together as much as we can, but it's dropped off more rapidly than I've ever seen outside of the Great Recession.
And maybe this is kind of an obvious point to make, but what, again, would you attribute that to primarily? Are there multiple factors at work here, would you say? Or
the biggest factor is the pace of interest rate increases, right? I could finance a retail property at 3.5% 12 months ago to the day, and that debt is pricing between 6 and 6.5%. So the interest rates have effectively doubled. Your bid-ask spread, I would say that you look at the cap rates from 2022, compare them to 2023, and they're off, but they're not off tremendously in terms of basis points. You look at your average retail property, and you know the pricing last year was a 5 cap plus or minus. You know, the comps from Q1 of this year were 5.25. So you say, okay, pricing only slipped 5%, 25 basis points. That's not an accurate reflection of what's happening. The reality is the only people selling right now in 2023 are generally people that are getting prices from 2022. So if they can sell at pricing from a year ago, they'll trade. Otherwise, they're not selling at all. That's why volume is down so dramatically. Investors on net lease retail typically were not taking variable rate financing. They have fixed debt at 3 to 4%. They can hold on to these properties. They're not under pressure. So they're simply not selling. There's a disconnect, and you have a market that's very kind of anemic. There's low velocity. There's just not much going on because that seller is saying, hey, I have great debt on this piece. I'm going to wait for the market to fix itself. I'm going to wait for cap rates to come back down. I'm not going to go take a loss from what I paid a year ago or 2 years ago. So that's the positive spin on this is I don't see a lot of retail property going into foreclosure like office, where you've got variable rate financing and these investors are not going to be able to service their mortgages. We don't have that kind of problem with retail or net lease right now.
Well, Patrick, I wanted to follow up on that very important point that you've just made with a question about the capital markets strategies. And in this challenging environment, are you finding that there are some strategies that are workable that enable investors to get financed?
It's the obtaining financing is obviously more challenging. You have fewer banks that are purely willing to lend at any rate. So you're seeing the banks that are remaining and interested in lending, some of them are quoting very, very wide rates. I mean, I was personally quoted on a $2 million retail property I'm buying right now. I had banks quoting me 6% that we ended up going with, and then I had banks quoting me 7.5%. They were purely non-competitive. Their board is trying not to put money out, et cetera. Larger down payments are required, which some investors just don't have that cash available. So that creates a challenge and a problem. The borrower is needing to sign personally and take recourse on these loans. Non-recourse debt is very, very hard to find. So that not only is the rate, which is one component of a loan, the rate is higher today, but the sort of restrictions and qualifications, the borrower must be a lot more organized, well-capitalized personally, and they're going to have to put more cash into the actual deal to get financed. So everything is just tightened from that perspective.
You just mentioned an example of a bank loan, and I'm wondering whether in this climate, again, you're noticing any change in the mix of lenders who are open to exposure in retail net lease. And whether is it primarily that you're seeing the usual sources that you were before the interest rate hikes started? Or are there any other categories that might be interested in lending on these properties more so than they were before?
The main debt product that is becoming more commonly used as things have been disrupted is the private debt fund. And that's going to be almost mezzanine financing. It's more expensive from a rate standpoint. You're talking 10, 11, 12% money. But this is non-bank debt, and it's not commercial mortgage-backed securities, i.e. it's not Wall Street. It's a private group of well-heeled investors that, you know, put a couple $100 million together, and they're lending out at high, high interest rates to sort of bridge or rescue projects. There's a dozen plus funds out there like that across the country available to retail landlords and developers. And there are more and more of these funds that are frankly being raised right now. You know, it's a good time to be in the debt business. If you can take a first trust deed, right? If you can be in a position where you're in first position to take back a property if something goes wrong, I'd rather not take equity risk today, and I would rather control the debt, because you can go ahead and put that debt out at 10, 11, 12% right now. And, you know, investors are not objecting to those rates. If you quoted somebody 10% a year ago, they would have told you you were out of your mind. You know, I have people begging me to find them a 10% rate lender in this environment right now, depending on the amount of down payment, et cetera.
At least one other indicator that I'm sure you're watching very closely right now is cap rates. And given all the moving parts in the capital markets, what is your sense right now about the direction of cap rates, especially in net lease retail? Any sense of that so far in 2023, of which way they're going?
Cap rates my opinion is that cap rates from the bottom, and you have to look at the spectrum of what your asset is, right? I tend to look at value, the decline in value next to cap rates, right? So mm-hmm. I can't just put a statement together that says, hey, cap rates have moved 50 basis points. Mm-hmm. Because I would tell you, yeah, the product I was selling, you know, very simple McDonald's and Chick-fil-A product, I was selling those leases at 3.5 to 3.75 cap rates a year ago. They've moved to 4, 4.25 cap rates, right? So they moved 50 basis points. But on product where I'm selling at a 7 cap, right, 50 basis points isn't enough. That 7 cap product has moved to 8. So I look at it as more like values have moved plus or minus 10%. I think they've got another 5 to 10% to go. You know, I think we've corrected about 20% from peak so far. If you wanted me to make a generic statement, I think cap rates have moved plus or minus 100 basis points across the board. Debt has moved 300 basis points. So by comparing cap rates moving 100 basis points and debt moving 300, the seller is still arguably being overpaid. It's still a seller's market. To some extent, buyers are not getting the deals that they expected relative to how much debt has moved. So the buyers that are still out there are frankly tolerating lesser cash flow, and they're tolerating, you know, low returns with negative leverage. The cap rates have not moved enough to offset where debt has adjusted. That would therefore lead me to conclude that cap rates have some room to continue rising. I certainly hope that's not the case. I do think we've seen the brunt of the pain for stabilized net lease retail. I don't think cap rates are going to move another 100 basis points, but I think they've got at least 50 more to move. So, and I'm optimistic by the time that, you know, cap rates move another 50 bips, you know, in 6 to 12 months here, we're going to start to see the Fed pull interest rates back down. And hopefully that calms the markets a little bit.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit more about your own professional journey. For example, would you mind telling us about a few of your most important mentors in the years that you've been in the business?
Sure. My mentors have kind of shown up in a few different categories. They've been other brokers, and you know, my best mentors have been brokers that frankly work at competing firms. There's a stigma if you work at certain brokerage shops, and I'm not going to name names, but that everyone's your competitor. I've kind of looked at things differently. You know, I'm on conference calls and quarterly golf outings with, you know, some of the top brokers in the country that have teams similar to mine. And we all share best practices. We share strategies. We share clients. So, you know, I think you tend to see that when you get to a certain level in the business, and this is not a comment to boast, but the, you know, the top guys tend to play nice in the same sandbox. And we're all kind of trying to figure out which way is up because of the direction this market is going. So, you know, I think if you're a younger person in the business, while it's certainly healthy to be competitive, you know, some of your best mentors and outlets for support, frankly, will be those people from competing firms. So to give you some specific names, Carlos Lopez at Hanley Investment Group, the first transaction I did in my career when I was 22 years old and needed a paycheck was with Carlos. He represented a seller. I represented a purchaser. And he frankly held my hand through this transaction and got me paid. And since then, he's become a dear friend and mentor. My clients, Ryan Schnell, now at Northern California with Brownman Development Group. Ryan was with a company called Pacific Castle in Newport Beach. We did leasing for Ryan's company. He became a mentor to me. Greg Liscotti, the nation's largest developer for a number of retailers, Chick-fil-A being one, taught me the business in addition to hiring me and giving me a shot when I was very, very young. So your clients and your mentors become friends. You know, you end up building the relationship beyond simply one that is monetary. So, I mean, my best friends, my clients, my mentors, you know, I'm showing up for their kids' bar mitzvah. I'm donating to their political charity. You show up for each other. You know, my dad's afflicted with Alzheimer's. My clients donate to him when I have events that I sponsor. So this whole business evolves from something beyond, you know, what we're paid to do to something I think a little bit more interesting, which is everybody takes care of each other. I mean, that's a very rosy way to look at things. I have very tough days and I have people that I want to just strangle, but the reality is, for the most part, at a certain level, everybody takes care of each other. And I've been fortunate to get myself in a position where I enjoy working every day. My clients, again, are my friends for the most part. And that's right where you want to be, right? If I could work with people that were respectful and kind and that continue to hold each other accountable and push each other, if that's my client type, that I'm servicing, no, I've got the best job on earth.
Well, I'd like to continue on the theme of professional practice for just a moment. When you were a CPE Starter Watch back in 2015, we asked you for the best advice that you have received at that point in your career. And Ryan Schnell, who you just mentioned as one of your mentors, was the source of the best advice that you would pass along to us at that time. And again, at that point, he was director of leasing at Pacific Castle. And Ryan told you, don't be an idiot broker. The industry has a poor reputation for a reason. Know your leases inside and out and act with more professionalism, organization, and follow-up. Now, maybe this principle seems almost self-explanatory for anybody who's in any business in some ways, but could you expand on that? How has following Ryan's advice contributed to what you've been able to do?
I would tell you in a market that's frothy in a positive way, when cap rates keep going down, when the economy's on fire, everybody wants to be a broker. It's very easy to say, oh, this guy is very successful. He's, you know, 25 years old. He sold all these deals. You know, but the reality is, I didn't know that much when I was that age, and neither do a lot of these people that are coming out of the woodwork in the brokerage business. I mean, there are kids that are cold calling me on my listings. I've never heard of them. I don't know who they are. They've been in the business 2 years. In a good economy, you end up seeing the ranks of brokerage firms flooded with candidates that may not necessarily have any idea what they're doing, but the market supports them and they can make a living. In a recession, in a challenging environment like today, you know, what's the old adage or expression is when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked, right? It's a very, very challenging time to be a broker, and you need to have more skills than, hey, bud, I can get you a good cap rate. You need to bring more to the table than being able to aggressively cold call and market yourself as a smart guy that can get good cap rates and results, because the results may not be good right now. We're doing more problem solving for owners than we are making them happy, because we're making them a bunch of money. We're in the loss prevention business right now as brokers. Mm-hmm. We're not necessarily in the equity or gain creation business like we used to be. Right. It's the conversation I have with an owner is, I'm losing a tenant. What do I do? My loan is due. What do I do? Right. It's much more stressful, painful, frankly, not happy conversations where, you know, whereas a year ago it was, hey, you bought this at an 8 cap. We're going to sell it for you and get you a 6 cap, and we're going to make you a few million bucks, and everybody's high fiving and happy. Right. That's I can't wait for those days to come back. But the reality is that we're here to solve problems, and the conversation is much more nuanced. It's, hey, I need an equity partner. I can't keep floating bills for this project. You know, so suddenly I'm not even a sale broker anymore. I'm an investment banker, and I'm running around looking for money to recapitalize a project. So, you know, you wear very different hats in this market than you did 5 years ago, or even a year ago for that matter.
Well, while we're on the topic of giving advice, I'm going to turn the tables on you for a moment. Now that you've been in the business for many years, you are a top, very experienced investment advisor yourself. Do you have a piece of advice, if you had to pick one, that you would convey, whether it's to, could be to professionals who are just starting out, or even to some of your own peers?
And my advice to anybody starting in the business would be, save your money and be very careful with your lifestyle and your personal spending, and frame your conversations around eagerness and openness to learn. That's from your clients, from others in the business, and frame it around, how can I help you? Everybody that's starting out wants to kind of jam their script down somebody's throat that they're prospecting, right? Their script on why they should hire them. Just listen. I mean, shut up, ask the right questions, be respectful, and listen to what the need is. If you're cold calling somebody or you're going after business, if somebody doesn't know you, it may take a couple questions to get them comfortable telling you what they need, where their pain point is. Somebody's not just going to tell you all of their problems as soon as you call them because you're a nice guy and you're polite on the phone. So, I mean, the human element, especially for young people, knowing how to talk to people, knowing how to be respectful of adults is huge. That's the biggest issue for people under the age of, call it whatever, 30, 25, is, you know, they've been at home through a pandemic, and they live on devices, and they don't know how to go talk to human beings. I mean, when I was in my 20s, I was hosting dinners of, you know, a dozen or so REIT executives. It took me a couple of years to get there, right? Even in that age. But, you know, I was able to hold a conversation with, and, you know, wine and dine and get people in a room. You know, obviously that was very challenging. It was awkward for me at first, et cetera. But I mean, I do everything in person. I mean, I'm on the phone all day, but I'm on a plane every single week in the offices with my clients, talking to them, meeting with them. I mean, there's an old school way of doing things that's kind of lost on a younger generation. I mean, you can't just run a brokerage business sitting on a computer or a phone.
And to your point, it really does seem as though there has been a major generational shift since you started out in the business a little while ago. So is that really your impression?
Yeah, brokerage is a young man's sport, and I mean, God, I'm feeling old now, right? And yeah, by the time I'm 40, I'll have been doing this almost 20 years, and there's going to be some young kid that's, you know, that version of where I was, and he's going to have probably better ways of doing things, different ways of doing things, but you know, he's going to be better adept to using technology, et cetera. So someone's going to go reinvent the business yet again. But yeah, it's a young man's sport, but you know, some of the old traditional ways of doing things haven't gone away, which is it's a people management business. I don't look at, you know, a property's fine. I can understand a lease. I can understand a building, but I don't collect data on buildings. I collect data on people, right? I'm a people manager. You know, young people say, hey, I'm the expert in XYZ building. It's like, okay, I know all that stuff. I can learn that. And I can learn that quickly. Learn how to manage people and their expectations and their moods and their needs, and learn how to be empathetic, and you'll be much more successful. Everything else is book learning. You can pay somebody to do that stuff. You know, you can spend a weekend reading a bunch of leases and become an expert in the lease. It doesn't really matter if the person who owns that property doesn't want to talk to you or they don't like you. So.
Well, now we come to one of my favorite parts of the Investment Matters podcast. Though it sometimes seems that we're all trying to work 24/7 these days, even the busiest commercial real estate professionals have to take a break every now and then. Patrick, when you spoke with us for your Stars to Watch profile 8 years ago, you mentioned that one of your favorite ways to go off the clock involved a particularly strenuous outdoor activity. Are you still informed with that form of recreation, or have you found other directions, other outlets in the years since?
Yeah, I'm an avid rock climber, so it's harder to do. It's harder to do because, to your point, I haven't been able to get off the phone. And in a time like this, I'm on the phone more because everybody's stressed out. They're worried about the market, et cetera. But yeah, if I have free time, I'm on the side of a wall on an excursion for, you know, 2 to 3 nights at a time. I don't have a device on me. It's very, very refreshing. If I can get out and away from a device, I mean, that's the greatest luxury on earth for me. The older you get and the more you do anything to a certain level, time and space become your commodities, right? It's not, and trust me, I've got money problems just like other people have money problems, to be frank, but you know, money is not the root of my stress. It's lack of time and lack of ability to control my time. And doing activities to maximize the value of every extra minute that I have is how you're also going to maximize your income. So, yeah, when I can get outside and clear my head, I work out minimum an hour a day. I'll go crazy if I don't. So, you know, normal people, if they can stretch for 20 or 30 minutes or do what they do, they're happy. I mean, if I can't get 5 miles down on a run, I'm going crazy. My energy level's too high.
Well, I also hear that when you can find the time, you do like to go out and see the world, even beyond the U.S. borders. Are there any international destinations that you count as your favorites or any particularly memorable trips that you've taken?
My girlfriend is Swiss. She's a citizen, so she's bilingual. I'm not. So we drink a lot of wine. So we went to France last summer, went through Burgundy, did a wine tour for a week. We liked it so much, we went back in December for New Year's. So we've been, you know, we'll sort of pick a country and we'll take a couple trips. And yeah, I think we're going to start knocking out parts of Italy this summer. So I mean, we'll see if the world isn't in a deep recession and I'm making enough of a living and I can be comfortable taking a vacation, you know, we'll see. But We try to eat and drink well and live well if we can, and, you know, turn off the device for a couple days. So,
well, it sounds like that you are able to find a few ways to decompress every now and then. So that's all to the good.
Mental health, to your point, my other advice for young people is get your house in order mentally, spiritually, emotionally, et cetera. You're not going to be a beacon of calm to your clients in a turbulent market if you've got substance abuse problems, if you don't have a family life, if you don't have good relationships with others in your core circle, if you don't have a support system. So take your mental health seriously, right? Whatever that is, go see a therapist, go talk to a priest, do what you need to do. But clients can see through if you're a mess emotionally, mentally, et cetera. Clients can read that. They can feel that. Our job is to bring comfort to and confidence to the people that hire us. And if you're a mess personally, emotionally, et cetera, they're going to see through that and you're going to have a harder time.
That's all essential advice and definitely words to live by. Well, Patrick Luther, it's been a pleasure having you on Investment Matters. Really appreciate your time today. And thanks so much for sharing your insights with our audience.
Enjoyed speaking with you anytime.
That was my conversation with Patrick Luther, the co-founder of the Net Lease Retail Advisory Group at SRS. He spoke with us from his home base in Southern California. I hope you've enjoyed this month's episode of Investment Matters. Please join us for more discussions with the people who are shaping commercial real estate investment today. You can find archived episodes of Investment Matters and other CPE podcast series on Apple Podcasts and on our website, commercialsearch.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.